Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
The greatest achievements in human culture have been born and nurtured in cities. In the arc of human history, though, cities are actually a relatively new invention. They are only possible when a civilization has moved beyond total dependence on subsistence farming for food. The way cities are organized and function have certainly changed dramatically over the years. Today, the headlines are filled with news of empty office buildings and deteriorating conditions of cities filled with burgeoning homeless populations. So what does the future look like for cities, and how important are they for the future of modern civilization? Authors Ian Golding and Tom Lee Devlin take a deep dive into the history and future of cities in their new book, Age of the City. We are very lucky to be joined by them this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. A pleasure to be on your show.
Well, let's start with why you wrote this book. What motivated you to write it, and how long did it take to put together the research?
I've been wanting to do this book for a very long time, because what we've observed is that far from globalization and more connectivity leading to a world that is flat, as Tom Friedman suggested, or the death of distance, as others have suggested, place is becoming more important. The world is becoming more spiky, and where people are born, where people are working, increasingly determines their life chances. So this paradox of a sort of technologies that allow you to work anywhere and increasing importance of place has led me to want to do this for many years. And I was lucky to team up with Tom, initially as my research assistant, now he's at The Economist magazine, to work on this and to try and uncover not only why cities have been the driving force of change and all human progress has really come out of cities and will continue, but also what we can do about this increasing challenge that we have some cities doing really well, some cities not doing well, so growing spatial inequality, and also some real threats to cities. Remote work is threatening cities, climate change is threatening cities, cities are the super spreaders of pandemics, and of course the politics of many people is against big metropolitan cities. So these are real threats cities face, and we're very concerned that unless they address these threats, our economies will slow down, our progress will slow down, and cities can collapse. So that's what we really are working on and the reason for the book now.
You write about three interconnected forces that were key to unleashing human progress. Can you talk about each of those and then bring into the reason why cities were so instrumental in having these all work together?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Is Tom
on the call
as well?
I'm happy to jump in on that one.
Yep,
I'm happy. I'm happy to jump in on that one. Yeah, so we talk about the three forces really driving human progress as cooperation, specialization, and invention. And really, all three of those have been kind of nurtured and catalyzed in cities. So if I take those in turn, cooperation, this is kind of the idea that, you know, humanity is... it's a eusocial species, to use the term from biology, like, say, bees or ants. We are a species that really requires cooperation in large numbers to reach its potential. And for most of human history, up until the point of the first cities, we were like a colony of bees without a hive. We didn't have the mechanism to learn how to cooperate in large numbers that the city effectively acts as. So we describe how cities are very intimately linked to the birth of religion, of government, and other mechanisms through which humans are able to cooperate in large groups to achieve things that individuals cannot achieve on their own. Now, the second mechanism is specialization. We talk in the book about the example of a gentleman who tried to make his own sandwich from scratch. Everything from growing his own wheat to, you know, having his own cow to produce milk for cheese and so on. The whole process took him about 6 months and about $1,500 to do. And we use that as a way of illustrating that so much of our economy depends on a division of labor to function. And cities really have made that possible, both in the immediate community of this city, but also in facilitating global trade as sort of connecting nodes in globalization. And then the third force that we talk about is invention. And, you know, from the wheel to mathematics to astronomy to the inventions that drove the Industrial Revolution, so much of technological progress has been birthed in and has been amplified in cities throughout history. And so we talk about why that is the case, this idea that cities really foster a kind of cross-pollination of ideas, a dissemination of ideas that is really behind technological progress over the long term of history.
One of the things that I found fascinating in the book is the way you take on the notion that certain cities, like St. Louis, for example, have experienced a rather dramatic rise and fall over time. And other cities today are becoming superstars. Let's talk a little bit about the dynamics. What causes a city like St. Louis to have the kind of roller coaster ride of rise and fall? And where does it leave them?
Yeah. Historically, cities developed mainly because of natural resources. So proximity to waterways, to ports, to harbors, to lakes, crossroads over rivers, and other natural endowments. And then, of course, near to mines, near agricultural areas. Those were the things that drove cities. And certainly, when through the Industrial Revolution, we see this in the cities that developed in parts of the U.S., near coal mines, for example, and also in the UK, in Britain and in France and elsewhere, near the natural resources. But as that has become less and less important, and what's really driving city development now is where do people want to live? Where is the clean air? Where do graduates want to live? Where do young people want to live? Where are you most able to attract talent to? Who offers the best entertainment? Who offers accommodation and neighborhoods that people want to live in? And we've seen this very rapid transformation from sort of manufacturing economies to knowledge economies, driving what is making cities grow and is what is making them successful. And it's that which continues to change over time. So we see much more emphasis now on cities which are located near universities, for example, on cities located near major airport hubs, which are global, on cities where there's a lot of acceptance of diversity of immigrant communities with different subcultures. And more we're seeing this diversity and this knowledge-based economy determining which cities are becoming superstars and which are not.
Roger had mentioned in his question St. Louis, and I recall that there was a highlight that St. Louis once had a significant number of the Fortune 500 companies, but it had decreased. What led to that?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in there. I mean, there's lots of elements to that, but I think one of the biggest factors is consolidation. So in the last few decades, we've seen the consolidation of many industries in America into a small number of very large firms. And a moment ago, Ian was talking about this idea of superstar cities. Increasingly, we're also seeing superstar firms, a small number of firms capturing much of the revenue and the profit in industries. And really, for the most part, what we see is that those very large market-leading companies tend to be located in very large, typically coastal, major global cities. And so that has meant that, you know, a lot of kind of call it mid-tier banks or smaller industrial firms that used to generate a lot of employment in more middle-sized cities have been folded into larger entities, which has meant those jobs have disappeared from those places.
Cities have always had a degree of division between rich and poor. That division, though, is becoming increasingly dramatic. What is driving what you guys labeled as the Great Inversion?
There are a number of factors. One is within cities, there's growing inequality. And then between cities, there's also growing inequality. And they're driven by different factors. Within cities, it tends to be driven by the pushing out of many people from inner city neighborhoods, the gentrification process. Working people are having to commute over longer distances, further from where the jobs are. That's taking longer, it's costing more, and the jobs that they can do often unskilled and semi-skilled jobs are also becoming harder to find because these cities are specializing no longer in making things on a production line, but in either in the knowledge economy jobs, so professions, law, finance, and other professions, as well as in the caring jobs. And that's a very wide span in income. So the difference in incomes between top paid and lower paid jobs has widened. And with that, inequalities have widened. And of course, affordability of housing has become much, much more difficult in inner cities. And between cities, it's because some cities are really benefiting from these positive agglomeration effects where they're getting new jobs, they're attracting good people, and therefore new firms want to locate there, and others are lagging behind. And mobility between places has gone down dramatically. In the U.S., people are about half as mobile now between cities and between counties and states as they were 50 years ago. And that's largely due to the affordability of housing, but also things like public transport and the lagging of maintenance and the decay of public transport. It's also due to things like school places, care home places for elderly parents. Lots of factors have come together. It means that people are very reluctant and find it very difficult to move. And so you get this increasing phenomena of very high unemployment and low income in some places and very high incomes and full employment in others, and people not moving anymore between them in the way they used to do.
You talk about this concept of a great inversion. What do you mean by that?
Tom?
I'm happy to take that. It's not a phrase that we coined. Alan Ehrenholt is a journalist who wrote a book on the topic. And really what it describes is, if you go back to kind of the era of the Industrial Revolution, your factories were primarily located in inner city areas, and working class people tended to live in the inner rings surrounding those areas. Typically, those were very poor neighborhoods, very polluted. And over time, what happened, particularly as cars became more affordable to the masses, is both wealthy and middle class inhabitants of cities moved further out into suburbia. But what we've seen in the past few decades, actually, is that increasingly well-paid professionals have moved back into inner city areas. And there's lots of debate as to what the root cause of that shift back towards the inner city area is caused by. But a big part of it that we talk about in the book is really shifting attitudes and values. You know, a new generation of well-educated workers really rejecting the kind of conformity and commercialism of a suburban lifestyle and wanting something a little bit more diverse and perhaps authentic that they can get on offer in the inner city. And so you've seen this process of wealthy workers in industries like tech or law or finance and moving into more artistic neighborhoods in inner cities. And increasingly the result of that has been the gentrification of those areas, the redevelopment of those areas. And unfortunately, that has meant that a lot of poorer inhabitants of those areas have actually been pushed out into kind of the far suburbs or the exurbs of many cities, which has led to a really horrendous commuting burden for a lot of those workers in jobs like, say, cleaning and childcare. And so that's really what we mean by this great inversion, this shifting geographic pattern of income and wealth in cities.
As we discuss the future of cities, we have to talk about the implications of remote work. What's going to happen with regards to the ability for white-collar employees to work from home, and what's that going to mean for cities?
So the pandemic dramatically accelerated remote work. The technologies have been there for a while for telecommuting, for remote work, but it made it more acceptable. And we have seen in the U.S., I think now an average of 2 days a week, a remote for classes of work where this is possible. Of course, many, many jobs, essential jobs, but also some professional jobs like medics and others, can't work remotely. And what this is doing is to I fundamentally changed the nature of commercial real estate. We're seeing offices which are heavily underutilized. Those that exist need to be refurbished and designed so people don't just come to work and sit behind a computer, because you can do that at home. But offices are meeting spaces, and you want to make them as attractive as possible for people to come to. But this reduction in demand for offices is leading to real pressures on the ecosystems around them, the baristas, the barbers, the dry cleaners, and all the other people that service offices and service this mass footfall, this mass commute that used to happen. It's also putting public transport systems under severe strain, because public transport systems rely on very dense commuting at certain hours of the day to keep themselves financially viable. So there's a real worry that this is undermining the finances of cities. I think in San Francisco we see what can happen with this, that you get this city's income going down, the services they provide and their ability to control crime going down, and this leads to potentially to a downward spiral, which is very, very dangerous for the future of cities. It also undermines creativity and productivity, because jobs are essentially apprenticeships, and people learn not on Zoom or remotely, but they learn, particularly young people, but everyone learns from being with other people in many, many jobs. And so there's a real question about how you ensure that people develop a culture and knowledge, and therefore bring people in at least some of the time, is important. So this is having a dramatic impact and needs to be very carefully managed not to negatively impact on cities.
You framed a discussion about the impact of pandemics on cities by talking about the impact of the Black Death. How do you see pandemics threatening the role of cities in the future, and why are the lessons from the Black Death important?
Well, I mean, I think one of the big observations of the Black Death was that cities are both potential incubators of pandemics because of higher population density, and also important transmission mechanisms through which, because of trade routes, because of today airports and the like, diseases can be carried from place to place. I mean, one of the big things that we see when we look at past plagues like the Black Death, however, is that even though the mortality rate can be a lot higher in cities, and certainly that the prevalence of disease is a lot higher in cities, their ability to bounce back from pandemics tends to be very strong. That's certainly what we saw in the kind of the decades after the Black Death, as populations shifted back into urban areas, just because of the immense economic opportunities that cities present to populations. But you know, one of the things that we talk about in the book is that it's really critical in this period after the COVID-19 pandemic to reflect on what cities need to do to become choke points for future pandemics. You know, to just accept that, you know, cities are going to be places that amplify the transmission of disease, we argue is not good enough. What we really need to be doing now is thinking about, you know, what have we learned in terms of testing and tracing, in terms of other protocols for managing pandemics, to ensure when the next disease inevitably comes along, that cities will be able to control it better than they did this time around.
As we wrap up the interview, I want to look at those problems and challenges facing cities in the future. Can you outline, you know, some of those challenges, and how should we start to address them?
Well, one of the challenges is this question of remote work and how cities adjust. I think what we argue in the book, Age of the City, for is much more mixed residential and commercial real estate. So the whole idea that you have central business districts and then people live far away in the suburbs needs to be rethought. It needs to be rethought in the context of having people live much closer to work, 15-minute cities, have access to entertainment and work nearby, be clean. So obviously we're moving to an electric vehicle environment, public transport, walking, cycling. How you create a city that's much more livable, for all ages, because we have rapidly aging populations in many cities, as well as very young populations, and ensuring that cities meet the great challenges of climate change and pandemics, which will be the real tests. Cities are very vulnerable. They're heat islands, but also you can have much lower carbon intensity and much lower emissions per person or per unit of economic activity from a city. So how you do that, how you redesign cities to make sure that they become real agents for change in terms of addressing climate change, and also how they become the place where we stop future pandemics rather than super spread them.
One of the things you talked about that I just want to touch on before we go was that different cities around the world have taken a different approach to the role of government in subsidizing housing. I believe it was Vienna that has this really different approach to that. Talk a little bit about those differences and what lessons you think we can learn from them.
Well, I think there's a couple of points I would draw out. One is just the volume and amount of access to social or affordable housing that's provided by the government. In somewhere like Vienna, something like 60% of the renting population lives in housing that is subsidized in one way or another, which is really a huge percentage when you think about it. And the way the government has approached that is that you're up to a much higher threshold of household income are able to access subsidized housing, and that is paid for by a generalized tax on the population. And one thing that does is that it brings together a much broader range of the income spectrum into social housing, which helps mitigate some of the challenges that can emerge in these social housing communities around concentrated poverty. The other thing that I think is really important with social housing is making sure it's dispersed throughout the city. So this is something that London actually does comparatively well. Rather than having all social housing concentrated in one neighborhood, you will see it in spots throughout the city, even in very wealthy neighborhoods. You will have a council housing block here and there. And that has lots of benefits around ensuring that people are coming into encounters with people from all sorts of economic walks of life, and it also gives people from poorer backgrounds living in those social housing blocks access to things like the same schools as wealthier neighbors. So that really helps to avoid issues of concentrated poverty.
We've been speaking with authors Ian Goldman and Tom Lee Devlin about their new book, Age of the City: Why Our Future Will Be Won or Lost Together. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thank you so much for having us.
Journalists Dan Schwartz and Topher Sanders delved into what is causing monster trains to jump off tracks in their ProPublica article published in April of this year. The piece titled The True Dangers of Long Trains follows the story of the train derailment in Hinman, Pennsylvania, while uncovering key policies and business practices that highlight the dangers to all communities along railway lines. Joining us today is one of the journalists who wrote the article, Topher Sanders. Topher Sanders covers race, inequality, the justice system, and civil rights for ProPublica, and joins us this morning. Topher, thanks for being on Mountain Money.
Thank you. Sorry, I stepped on your intro there.
No, you're good. You're good. Appreciate it.
You can't derail Allison's intro.
Oh, my goodness. We're already into the train stuff. All right. Topher, let's begin. What drew you to investigate this topic, and how long did it take you to investigate and write the piece?
So altogether, we've been looking at the railroad industry for about 15 to 16 months. And we began in early 2022. We were very attracted to what was happening with workers on the yard. And as we did our investigation, we learned about these new dynamics in the railroad industry about longer trains. And workers continually told us that the pressures they were under to keep trains moving, build them bigger, build them heavier, was creating some of the concerns they had around safety. So as we dug into that, it felt like it was the natural first story for us to do. And as we were doing that reporting, Ohio happened. And it made it clear that we had made the right choice, that this was a very important and germane issue to dig into. And that's why we wrote that story.
And by Ohio, I assume you're talking about the derailment at Palestine?
Correct.
Okay. So give us a vision of what does it mean to be a long train? And then put it in some historical context. Obviously, massive amounts of goods and services move through containerized freight trains in this country. And what was a typical train length before, and how have they gotten longer? Give us some perspective, Tover.
Absolutely. So, you know, it wasn't untypical in the industry for you to have a train that, you know, exceeded a mile in length. And that's all the way, you know, from the 80s up to current. That wasn't a thing that was untypical. But there was a cap on where you could park a train. And that typically was about 75, 8,500 feet. That's how long they build what they call their sidings, is where they pull the train off of the main line, where they need to either do fixes to the train, get stuff off the train, et cetera. And when they brought in a new working dynamic called PSR, it really intensified the desire to make the trains as big as possible, to stack as many goods and elements on those trains and get them all moving as quickly as possible. And we saw the lengths of the trains explode to 2+ miles, even 3 mile, approaching 4 mile long trains. And that's what you started to see in recent years as all of the biggest freight companies get on board with this new business model called precision scheduled railroading.
And let's talk a little bit about the types of goods that travel on trains, because it's not just, you know, innocuous type items, you know, household goods. What is traveling along the railway lines nowadays?
Yeah, some of it is, as you described, you know, the types of goods, lumber, you know, plastic goods, just getting these important commodities to and fro. But then a lot of the material is also highly toxic, highly corrosive chemicals that nobody wants in their ground, nobody wants in their waterways, and definitely nobody wants exploding in their community. So there are, it ranges from everything from wood and lumber to propane gas and other types of explosive materials on these trains.
How does the length of a train affect its potential for accidents or derailments? Why does it matter that the trains are longer? I mean, they're still on a rail. I don't get it.
Well, what we learned when we did this investigation was that the physics and the mechanics of the train can change dramatically when you build it longer and longer. So where you place the goods on the train, you begin to create some physics concerns for yourself if you have a very long train and say you backload it. You put a ton of the tonnage, the weight, behind the train, in the back of the train. So as you're going over territory, if you have any hills, if you have any declines, what you can create is a buckling, you know, kind of dynamic where the train begins to press in on itself. And if you put the lighter cars in the middle, the physics are such that they can't handle that buckling and they can pop off of the rails. Mm. And that's exactly what happened in the accident that we examined in Hindman, Pennsylvania.
So the accident that took place in Hindman was in August of 2017, but regulators had already been investigating several long train accidents in which length was a culprit. You also mentioned how, you know, the railway workers were also mentioning concerns about these long trains. How often were these accidents happening, and who's in charge of the regulations?
So how often is a difficult question to answer. It's part of what really grew out of the conversation after Ohio, after the derailment in Ohio, is where can you find the data on how often a long train derails and how often long trains are even on the network? That's something that the regulator, and you ask who is the regulator is the Federal Railroad Administration. They're the body under the Department of Transportation that is responsible for ensuring safety on our train tracks. And they don't have the data to tell anyone how often this happens. Is it a serious problem? There is data inside the private companies. They have a decent understanding, as we've been told, of their networks, how often they put very long trains on their networks, how often they may have mechanical problems with those long trains, because derailing is one element of a long train that could happen. But you also, you know, the trains, the forces in the trains could just pull the trains apart. The materials used to hold those trains together sometimes can't handle the stress and the weight of a long train, and sometimes you just snap apart. And how often that happens, where it happens, under what conditions it happens, is a mystery. And it's something that the Federal Railroad Administration has been looking to want to gather more data on so we can have an answer for that very question, how often and where. But right now we don't know.
That's really interesting. We're used to thinking of a world in which most kinds of industrial accidents have associated reporting requirements. And I think what you're saying is that there is no mandatory or effective reporting requirement for railroads to report these kinds of things to the railroad administration. Is that just like a regulatory hole?
Yeah, it is. There's really no other way to say it but to say that it is. And the regulators know that they don't create their own parameters. They have to wait for Congress to jump in and codify this so there's something they can track. And so that's what they're doing, and that's what the Secretary of the Department of Transportation is attempting to do, is to push the envelope so that they can gather this information and also require the railroads to report this type of information, because right now that is not a requirement.
That really is striking. And do you have a sense of the history as to how it is that the rail... My cynical suspicions are that somehow the railroad industry was able to avoid that kind of reporting requirements due to political power. Am I right about that? Is there some other explanation for how it is that something that seems as fundamental as a reporting obligation has been left out of the regulations to date?
I think some of it's that. I think also it's... government moves slow.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of, we need to actually track the length of each and every train, or is there a way for us to gather that information, just wasn't part of the imagination when they were creating some of these regs. And that's the thing with the railroad industry, it being one of our foundational industrial achievements in this country, that a lot of the regulations for it go way back. Some of these have the number 18 something in front of them. When you talk about how old some of these regulations are, they've been updated and tweaked along the way, but those updates and tweaks have been somewhat far and in between. So I think it's a combination of the power the railroads hold and their lobbying efforts to kind of keep things at the status quo, but also some of the historical nature of the railroad, that some of these regulations are just quite old and maybe haven't kept up with the changes in technology, changes in business practices, et cetera.
The ProPublica article really takes the history, what's happened with the railroads, and puts it next to the crash in Hindman. And I want to have you talk just a little bit about that crash, because the article does a great job of not only writing about it, but there's a fantastic graphical illustration of the length of the cars, their approach into the city, and kind of, you know, what was being carried where and how it went wrong. Can you give us just kind of an overview of that train as it was approaching and what the engineers were starting to be worried about?
It was a big train. One of the conductors or engineers referred to it as big, heavy, and ugly. Some of the crews, there were multiple crews that operated this train, and the first crew, there was a switchover, there was a handover, if you will, and that first crew expressed some concerns about the size of the train and the way it was constructed. And then the train was handed over to another crew, and they had to, you know, decline down this pretty steep grade. And what they did to do that, and what was allowed for them to do, was to set a number of brakes and essentially ride the brakes down the hill. It's a practice that now the company doesn't do, and that the FRA came out pretty strongly, so did the NTSB, said, you shouldn't do that. You're the only company, large company, that does this. Please stop. And so coming down the grade, riding the brakes, they wouldn't do that today. And it was a big contributor to some of the buckling and the lack of control that the train had as it was going down into the city of Hindman. And that's exactly what happened. As it started getting closer to the city, a train, one of the cars popped off, started riding along off the edge, and then soon it was a cascading effect, and many more cars came off, and then there was the explosion.
So there was an explosion. Again, for our readers who don't know anything about this crash, obviously we've heard a lot about Palestine. Describe to us a little bit about the damage and destruction that was a result of the Hindman crash.
Yeah, there were a number of homes that were damaged and destroyed. One gentleman, literally, as he describes it to us, woke up with a train in his living room.
Not funny.
And is just counts all his blessings that he and his wife were up early getting ready for work or what have you, and they were not in their bedroom because their bedroom had been destroyed.
Wow.
And so it was a really devastating event. When the plume of smoke went up and fire, it was like a kind of a geyser fire just coming from this tanker car. The emergency response personnel there in the town knew immediately they had to gather everybody and start getting people ready to leaving the town, because you didn't know what was going to happen with that tanker car. So they ended up evacuating close to 1,000 people, and they had to stay away from their town for 3 days.
And is it my recollection that one of the materials that was part of the danger, was it molten sulfur?
There was some molten sulfur that was spilled onto the ground. I think the thing that was most concerning was the liquid propane gas, and not knowing what was going to happen with that tank or whether it was going to rupture and explode.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, this derailment cost the train company money. What did CSX end up spending to mitigate the impact?
Don't have total numbers on that. I think if I recall correctly, it was somewhere north of $6 million all told. But that's just off memory.
Sure.
But it was multi-millions of dollars, not to mention moving folks, putting them up in hotels, feeding people. You know, people had to leave their homes without their clothes and their goods. So CSX paid for that. And then they had to pay for the cleanup after.
As we wrap up our conversation, what do you see are the next steps for the fight to address long train derailments?
I think one of the big steps that's happening right now, the National Academies of Science is continuing its review to look at the matter. That's something that came out of the big Federal Investment Act. So they've been looking at the dynamics of long trains for about 6 or so months and should have a report for Congress. And I think that's going to be something to really pay attention to and see what the National Academies of Science Committee has gathered and where they landed on what needs to happen with long trains.
We've been speaking with journalist Topher Sanders about his article in ProPublica, The True Dangers of Long Trains. Topher, thanks for joining us this morning on Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
Parkites Jamie and Michelle Parker launched Summit, an outdoor brand, this past June. Jamie Parker joins me this morning to share with us the concept behind the brand and the products they produce. Jamie, welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Like most Parkites, you moved to Park City from elsewhere. Can you begin with your background and what drew you to the area?
Sure. So Michelle and I spent almost 15 years at Nike. So our background is in consumer products, and we spent, I guess, Portland is I guess we'd consider home base, or was, for that period of time. But the last 7 or 8 years we spent abroad, and so we'd been traveling around the world, an incredible experience, sort of working in different markets, and we moved back to Portland and probably thought our kind of travel days were done, and we got this incredible opportunity. I got a job opportunity here in Park City to run a headphone company. So a little bit of a change from sort of my Nike background, but stayed in consumer products. And I think, like most, getting an opportunity to live in Park City, a mountain town, access to the outdoors, really drew us here.
And so that brought you here. And what made you take off the headphones and launch a summit?
Really good question. I think this has been a really long time coming. Obviously, we're in the infancy of the brand. But I had thought probably for 10 or 15 years about wanting to start my own thing and really going on an entrepreneurial journey and really having the opportunity to learn from starting something from scratch. And so the idea of starting something had been there for a really long time. I think part of the impetus came from running the headphone company. It was a distressed turnaround situation. And I found myself just needing a creative outlet, something that wasn't focused on the P&L and changing a marketplace. And so I used the nights and weekends as an opportunity just to pull away from that and just exercise something creatively. And so the idea of Summit was born just almost out of circumstance and a little bit of luck of going through sort of an interesting career period and an awesome learning experience, but needing something else. And so that really led me and starting to talk to Michelle about the initial concepts of Summit.
So you launched Summit in June. I want to make sure that the audience knows Summit is spelled S-M-M-T.
What do you got against vowels?
Really good question. So it is rooted in some meaning. I think anybody who thinks about sort of a brand and who you want to be, part of that is starting with how consumers see you and what the brand name is. We played around with a lot of things, I think, as most entrepreneurs do. Summit really stuck with us. First, for the word, obviously sort of that reference to climbing peaks and reaching peaks. And in our vernacular, sort of we're not a technical brand. We're not trying to help people get to the top of a physical mountain, but it references those aspirational peaks of lifestyle and living an incredible life. And so that's where Summit started. And then obviously there was this nice secondary reference to Summit County and our hometown. When you drop the vowels, it also became sort of this really nice acronym for us that's really the brief for our brand. SMMT stands for Sustainable Mountain Marine Travel. And those four words together, obviously, we're trying to build something that's considered, that's thoughtful. We're very inspired by Park City's stewardship in the environment. The mountain and marine piece was, we obviously live in the mountains. We want to build things for the mountains. Obviously, building products for this type of environment sets a higher brief than most places. When you do that well, it also makes great product for other outdoor environments like the coast. Hence the marine piece, and both Michelle and I come from the coasts and have landed here. And then the travel piece is part of that idyllic lifestyle is getting those different outdoor experiences. So we wanted to make products that were great for mountain and for marine, but also for the travel in between. And so creating versatile products that allow you to get to those destinations was a part of that Summit lifestyle.
And the Powder Loft Tote is the first product launched. Tell us about it, and why did you decide to start with it?
Yeah, great question. I think for outdoor brands, a tote is not normally where you start. so unique in that sense. But the tote, strangely, has this deeply nostalgic connection for me. I grew up with a lot of opportunities to spend outdoor time on coasts, and grew up with canvas tote bags as sort of this connective tissue between some of my favorite people, my favorite moments, and my favorite places. And I've always loved the tote because it's such a versatile all-day, everyday carry. You know, wide open mouths, easy to carry lots of things. Just felt like a really nice blank canvas to start with. And this idea of reinventing the tote for our landscape, for our lifestyle, a modern mountain lifestyle, was that creative outlet that really sparked, you know, the start of Summit and why we wanted to sort of create this.
I want to go in. You talked a little bit about how if you create something for this environment, you know, mountains, Park City, that it is easily transferable to others. Your current product claims it's Park City proof.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about what do you have to take into effect to think about how something needs to be durable here?
Yeah. So obvious factors that go into mountain town living, you know, heavy sun exposure, heavy weather exposure, those things lead to sort of a higher bar when you're constructing products for this type of environment. So there's a couple of things that went into the Powder Loft tote that I think make it sort of unique in a category that's actually fairly large and with a lot of offering. One is you'll notice it has sort of a puffy, lofted aesthetic. We did that for a couple of reasons. Obviously, there's this amazing mountain aesthetic associated with that. But there were some performance benefits that you don't see in bags typically. So much more comfortable under arm than a canvas tote or some of the alternatives that you'd find in the market. It offers protection. So if you're carrying something valuable like a computer or you know, something that you're carrying along with you, that puffiness provides this nice little protection element to the bag that most bags don't have. And then there was this tertiary benefit, and we didn't honestly design it for this, but having insulation in a bag allows for insulation or performance benefits by cooling or warming. And so if you stick an ice block in this bag, things will stay cool for a little bit longer than they would in a normal bag, hence making something that's great for a Deer Valley concert or for the park or the Jordanelle or whatever your day, you know, happens to have in store. And so we started with that as sort of both this beautiful aesthetic benefit and then these performance benefits. On top of that, we use things like apparel level, think premium jacket level shells. So our product, the Powder Loft, is waterproof both on the inside and out. So it has two layers of waterproof protection. Our totes also have covers. So they zip closed, which most totes don't have. That helps when you're getting a little bit of snow or a little bit of rain for that added bit of protection. So those are the types of elements that we build into the products to make them more Park City proof. And then there are other elements. We think about Parkites or residents of mountain towns as super versatile, very active consumers. And sort of that muse allowed us to push things like organization, making sure this bag can help transition between some moments on the mountain to the moments in the gym to the moments at work. And so we wanted to think about every aspect and detail of the bag to make sure it lived up to kind of our consumer and our environment.
You do an excellent job of describing it, but nothing quite works as well as looking at it. And the pictures on the website are just fascinating. Where are they made?
So they're made in Indonesia. We have a relatively global sourcing base for such a small brand. That is a little bit of coming from over 15 years of sort of working in the industry. We chose our manufacturing partner for the Powder Loft in part because they are outdoor experts. It's where a lot of our higher-end outdoor products are built. But they're also a Blue Sign partner. And so they have certifications that give us more comfort around how they're treating energy, how they're treating water. They have sort of a higher discipline around being good stewards of the environment than what you'd find in Sanyuan Manufacturing Partner. And so that was another attraction to working with them.
We've got about 30 seconds left, and there's a lot we'd love to talk to you about, like the 1% for the planet. But how about instead you let the listeners know where they can find out more information about your company?
Sure. So the best place is smmtoutdoor.com. So our website is obviously 3 months old. It's not super robust, but there's all the information you could possibly want to find about our brand. And you can also sign up via email on the site to get information on some of the products that are to come.
Jamie Parker, we really appreciate you coming in this morning talking about your brand summit. Thanks for joining Mountain Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.